This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Hey folks, just a heads up before we start the show. Sarah had a technical issue come up on her end during this episode. Of course, we're all doing this from our home, so these things happen. It's just toward the very end of the show. You might hear a change in her audio, but it shouldn't affect things too much. Just a notice. All right, let's get into it. Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego, and I'm joined, as always, by Sarah Libby, our Managing Editor. Hello, Sarah.
Hello, Scott.
Andrew Keats is once again off. Maybe not next week. We'll see. Coming up on the show this week, Sarah, I don't know if you heard, we have a new president. Joe Biden.
I did hear.
Yeah. Things have changed, maybe. One of the things that changed, San Diego Public Affairs are going to have to deal with yet another high-profile personnel change. President Biden picked Cindy Martin, the superintendent of San Diego Unified School District, the second largest school district in the state, obviously the largest in San Diego region, to be Deputy Secretary of Education for his administration. We'll talk about that. We'll get into what may have led to her pick, her legacy here. She's the longest-serving superintendent in a while here. And the responses, some of the backlash so far, we'll have to check out. Biden has not yet, though, fixed COVID-19.
Rude.
We have three stories on that front this week. It is still obviously a problem. Where are we with vaccines? There's been some rebellious restaurants breaking rules. And then outbreak data has been shared with someone. At least virus data has been shared with someone, not the public, but the police. We're going to talk about that. All that's coming up in the show. Stay with us. So we're getting a lot of these surprising announcements in the weekend time these days. And last week, Sunday, the Biden administration, or at that point, transition, announced that San Diego Unified Superintendent Cindy Martin had been chosen to be the nominee for the Deputy Secretary of Education post. And so it's a Senate confirmation she'll have to get. And when that happens, she'll leave San Diego Unified. And there's a new person already appointed to cover the entire year. We'll talk about that. But let's start, Sarah, first with why her? So Biden said in his announcement for choosing her that he cited the district's graduation rate. We can talk about that, obviously, a lot. Its reading growth on national standardized tests and saying those are both better than other large school districts. I think one thing you pointed out was San Diego Unified is a big school district, and so it has national significance.
Yeah, I mean, it's the second biggest in California, and by virtue of that, it's one of the biggest in the country. And so I think it's easy for us to forget as we get mired in, covering its day to day. Like, anyone who leads San Diego Unified is by default a pretty high profile national education leader.
Yeah. And, you know, it's not actually odd. Like, Alan Burson ran the school district and went on to serve in the Clinton administrations and helped Barack Obama as well. These are high-profile folks. So they cited the growth in graduation rate and in some of its test scores, but there were some caveats. First is that the district does, San Diego Unified does outperform other very large traditional public school districts. However, you know, there are still some problems here.
There are. I mean, before, you know, we dig into those, I think there's something to be said. You know, we kind of poked at Cindy Martin earlier for her State of the District address, in which she was very characteristically like rosy and optimistic in a year when that really didn't seem to fit the tone. But in previous years, I think there's a big appeal in her kind of attitude and charm about education. And so I do think that that probably had some role in this. You know, she's a very effusive, optimistic speaker. She's like literally put on ruby slippers for her State of the District speech, and like that very, very gauzy, rosy kind of public school teacher attitude about it.
Yeah, it's worth reflecting back. So she was a teacher, and then she became a principal at Central Elementary, and kind of this like ever-present person in the district at all of these big discussions and such. And remember 2013, the district's superintendent decides he's going to step down in 6 months, and they just called her as a school leader of an elementary school. You know, she hadn't led a district anywhere or even been in a high-level administrator in a district. They call her and say, "We'd like you to be the superintendent." And without a national search or any search at all. And she accepts and then goes on to be one of the longest serving in San Diego Unified in quite some time. And I think, yes, a lot of that was due to she has a particular charisma, a kind of magnetic appeal about, you know, what she's trying to do and how she's trying to enroll people in that. And I think the central tension of her leadership was the desire and her ability to paint a very good picture about what they were doing there, while also having to or being forced to acknowledge real big problems and embracing the need to have vast infusions of money to solve big problems, right? Like, so she was always in the situation of saying, everything is fantastic. We're doing such a good job. However, we need billions of dollars, and there's also some big problems we're going to work on.
Yes, we need billions of dollars from the state. We need billions of dollars from taxpayers to improve our facilities, but also everything is perfect.
Yeah. All right, so let's get into some of the, there has been some pretty significant backlash among some communities about this thing. So let's just review. So again, she was highlighted for some of these performance measurements about this, how well the San Diego Unified has done on some of these big tests. So they have done better and have shown more improvement than other large school districts. But even with that, just 42% of fourth graders were proficient in math on the nation's report card. So remember, it's better than other places, but that means 58% of fourth graders in San Diego Unified are not proficient in a subject in which the U.S. is already lagging behind other countries. The big issue is this ongoing issue of the achievement gap, just how much worse Latino and Black students perform on some of these measurement and tests compared to white and Asian students. And that achievement gap, as it's always referred to, is something that is going to haunt the district and Martin's career for quite some time. So let's put this into perspective. One school that she has been obsessed with, and a lot of people have tried to grapple with for some time, is Lincoln High School. So remember, she took over the school district with a promise already set in motion, but she really articulated it more clearly than leaders had in the past, which is there should be a quality school in every neighborhood. That there was a longstanding tradition of people in particular south of the 8 who felt they had to leave their neighborhood to find a good school, and they wanted to reverse that and make sure that it was possible to stay in your neighborhood and have a school that you could have high confidence in. They rebuilt Lincoln High School in 2007, and she picked up the mantle to make sure Lincoln High School could serve, because you know, by 2016 or by 2014, the enrollment in the school had just collapsed. People were choosing other schools. Performance was down. And by 2016, she opened the school year. They had tried all these gimmicks. Remember, they had tried to do the early college.
Yes.
They're always trying to kind of rebrand what they were doing there. And it was just struggling. And they finally, that one year, 2016, decided to cut significantly the middle college program that they had there, where you could like have college courses on campus while you were going there to try to attract people who were high performing and wanted to get a leg up on college. And they were cutting that. And she announced then, we pulled this clip from 2016, about how excited and positive and optimistic. Again, this is that sort of Cindy Martin power, how optimistic she was about Lincoln High School.
Normally do, because there's one school in particular where I think we can really expect great things to happen this year, and that's Lincoln High School. I would like to ask, I don't usually do this, but I would like tonight to ask Shirley Peterson, our interim principal at Lincoln High School, and area superintendent Bruce Bivens to please come forward. And I'd like to ask them both to share what the current climate at Lincoln is and what kind of year you think we can look forward to at Lincoln as part of my report, since I have no student instructional matters.
So I had forgotten about this quote that happened, but it was kind of, you know, we talked about that disconnect in her State of the District address where education has literally stopped and she's saying the district is unstoppable. At the time she made this address, I remember Mario Corin was really jarred by it, our education reporter at the time. Things were not going well at Lincoln. They were going very, very badly. And so to say, I think we can really expect great things from Lincoln, it was kind of shocking, I want to say. It was that same disconnect where, like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. Well, so things continued to struggle at Lincoln. They have thrown out a succession of leaders of the school. And then just last year, our Will Hunsberry checked in about the Vision 2020. So this was that idea of having a quality school in every neighborhood. It was 2020, so he checked in on it. And there were some gains, but in particular in this cluster of schools, Southeastern San Diego, the Lincoln High cluster, things were really struggling. And if you look at Lincoln High School, and this was from the 2017-2018 years, it's kind of, there's some really troubling statistics still. So let's look at chronic absenteeism, for example. This is where somebody's gone so much that they are declared chronically absent, which itself has an indication about the environment of the school or the safety perceptions of the school or whatever. San Diego Unified School District's overall chronic absenteeism rate was 15.3%. At Lincoln High School, it was almost double that, 29%. The graduation rate that the Biden administration and others have cited and given credit to San Diego Unified for is at 87% for district-wide. At Lincoln High School, it was 79%. The dropout rate at Lincoln High School was almost four times the San Diego Unified rate, I guess a little bit over three times San Diego Unified's rate. And then there's all these anecdotal stories. Obviously, there's still people doing great things, students that leave that emerged from Lincoln High School who go on to do great things. I talked to one a few months ago. She was in an AP calculus class, and then it was just abruptly canceled. The class was just abruptly canceled in the middle of the year. And everyone admits that that was a horrible decision. It was just really jarring to her career as a student. She had chosen to go to Lincoln High School after having been in a charter school to be part of the community and support the school, the exact type of student they want to keep at Lincoln High School. And her mother said it was just, it was a trauma and it was a very difficult thing. And the worst part about it is you just couldn't picture something like that happening to a student in a different part of the city. And that is a theme that comes up constantly with these equity concerns.
It absolutely is. You know, we heard similar anecdotes about that middle college program where students showed up to their, you know, community college course and were just told, oh, this isn't happening anymore. This course doesn't exist. So you need to figure it out. And I mean, I can just imagine parents in Scripps Ranch or La Jolla being, you know, apoplectic about their child's college prospects being threatened in that way.
And so her contract was extended, and that was maybe some of these concerns is part of why Sharon Whitehurst Payne was the only member of the San Diego Unified School Board who declined to endorse or support that contract extension. She said it wasn't necessary. There's a lot of things to work on, that kind of thing. And then just this week, we've heard the local branch of the NAACP called on the Biden administration to reconsider this appointment. What did they reference in there?
So they did reference some of our own reporting about some of the disparities in the district, particularly Will Huntsbury's reporting on the disproportionate rates at which Black students are suspended. This has been something on the district's radar for years, and that they have said they had implemented plans to address. But nonetheless, it's pretty jarring, the disparities, as well as other statistics and studies showing all kinds of disparities in discipline and also in achievement and performance in some of the ways that we've been talking about.
One of the really interesting things about her career was how she was chosen. Remember, we talked about, so they needed a new school superintendent. They were talking about doing a big search. Then all of a sudden they called Cindy Martin and said, do you want this? And then they met in a closed session without any notice that this is what they were going to do, decided they wanted to hire her, and just announced that they had hired her. It became a pretty obvious violation, if not in the letter of the law, at least in the spirit of the law, about how you make these kinds of decisions, how you have these kind of public meetings. They got a lot of trouble for that. Cindy Martin herself said it was wrong to do it the way that they did it. She said in that, in an interview I did with her in 2013, it was a Tuesday, and they said, we've actually made a decision. And I said, how did you do that? You haven't talked to the community yet. You can't make a decision on what the children of San Diego need without wide community engagement. And they told her, don't worry about it. We'll handle the backlash from it. Well, something similar has happened. So they met right after Biden announced this in a closed session at San Diego Unified and decided that Lamont Jackson, one of the area superintendents for the district, who had for a while overseen the area of Lincoln High School and had also been in charge of human resources for the district, they announced that he would be the interim superintendent for the whole year. So not just like as they performed a search or whatever for the next couple of months, for the entirety of 2021. And that brought some of these other concerns. So there's a group called the Association of African American Educators, Lachey Sharp Collins, who ran for school board. She sent me a statement. She said, we will not tolerate another closed door appointment as it violates the Brown Act. She went on to say, our African American students and educators have suffered enough and demand that we secure a superintendent who is committed to providing equality for all students, supporting quality teachers in every classroom, transparency, and encouraging policy priorities that focus on closing the opportunity gap for African American students. NAACP, Association for African American Educators, these are real responses that are going to be kind of hard. I don't think she's going to struggle maybe getting approved by the Senate, but that's real backlash.
Yeah, it's real and legitimate backlash. I haven't seen any sort of response or attempts to mitigate it, so maybe, you know, they just won't respond at all and hope that it goes away. I think we'd be remiss also if we didn't talk about kind of the more hidden side of that, you know, devotion to like a rosy, very rosy view of how the district's going, which is a lot of transparency issues that we've run into, in addition to some outright hostility to reporters and journalists and other people, including the district's own employees who speak out. We have mentioned on this show before that one of our own reporters, the district's communications director, made jokes multiple times about her murder.
Yeah, he was talking to another reporter of ours, and he said, You know, you complained about another reporter's coverage of the district. Ashley McGlone does a lot of investigative work around finances and other things. And he said he laughed that hope we don't find her body washed up on the shore. And he did it twice. It was a very troubling thing. And Cindy Martin declined to punish him at all in that circumstance. We have a multi-year lawsuit going on about public records that that they have been unwilling to reveal. Sometimes we have a public records request in for a couple of years, and that just shows up after this happened recently. Then there's the big one about the situation with sexual misconduct. Let's go through this one real quick. So we had asked for records about a teacher in La Jolla High School who had been people had complained about. And we asked for records to try to find out some of those complaints and investigations. And the district said, what? No, don't have any, right?
Yeah. And it was always very troubling because some of the students who had come forward provided to us themselves the emails that they had sent. And we knew the emails existed. We had them in our possession. And so for the district to come back and say, we have nothing. Well, we had actual proof that that was not true. And so we knew that they were withholding those individual emails. We didn't know what else they were withholding until the statewide teacher credentialing committee got involved to investigate this teacher. And at that point, they subpoenaed the district for its records. And lo and behold, they came to us, you know, several years after this all got underway and said, oopsies. We found boxes in a storage closet, which take that explanation for what you will. That is what they've said. And not only were those emails that we had insisted all along existed, because we knew that they did, it wasn't just those, but it was some deeply troubling information that showed that this same teacher, they'd received complaints about him in the past, including that he had stuck his hands down a student's pants, which is criminal behavior against a student in the district. And they did not provide that information to the police, which they're legally obligated to do.
Yeah. And so they picked Lamont Jackson to be the interim superintendent. Now, there's a lot of different stories, but one of them, Cindy Martin is known, I think if you looked at her own management over the district, one of the things she'll be known for and that'll be part of her legacy for a long time is how many principals she's replaced, right? She that was her main thing. She was a principal. You got to get a good principal in. They're the only ones you can have all this, like, sort of unilateral authority over, and you can put high quality people in there. They can raise the standards, and it's had some success. Edison Elementary, for instance, we profiled last year, has had a remarkable turnaround. A lot of it based on the culture that the principal was able to bring in. But there was one principal change they made several years ago, and it was really, really gnarly. Okay, Mitzi Litsuraga was the principal at the School for Creative and Performing Arts. And then one day in, what was it, 2015 or so, she was just abruptly fired. And she was well-loved, so it became this, like, big scandal about why was she abruptly removed from that position. And it emerged that Marnie Foster, who was the board member representing that area, School of Creative and Performing Arts was this super well-known school in southeastern San Diego, a magnet school, so people from all across San Diego would go to it. It was it's a highlight of that area in the district. And Marnie Foster's son, she was a school board member, and her son went to the school, and he started to have some trouble at the school. And in fact, one of the counselors gave him something of a negative recommendation for college. Well, Marnie Foster, the school board member, was so mad about this, she started putting pressure on the superintendent, Cindy Martin, and on Lamont Jackson, the area leader for the school district there, to do something about it. And they did. One of the counselors who wrote the evaluation, Kim Abagat, was suspended for 9 days. She told us, she said, I was punished for telling the truth. And then they met with Mitzi Litsaraka, and she had kept this boy, the student who was the son of the school board member, from going to prom because he hadn't...
Right. Disciplinary issues. Yeah. Yeah.
Lamont Jackson, the area superintendent, met with her and said, he will be going to that dance. And further, we need to talk about what you're going to be doing in the next year. And within a very short period of time, she was removed from the school as the principal. And then Cindy Martin finally recognized and acknowledged that it would be wrong to say that that pressure was not part of the story about why the principal was removed. So in essence, confirmed that the principal of this school was removed because a son of a school board member had gotten a negative evaluation for college and had been, you know, denied this opportunity to go to prom.
And to kind of wrap everything up in a nice little bow, as far as what we've been talking about, that was also one of our first big victories in court as far as pursuing public records. And a judge determined that the district illegally withheld emails from us that would have shed light on how these decisions were being made and how this all played out. And so they, again, you know, in this effort to keep it rosy, they withheld, in violation of the Public Records Act, emails that the public was entitled to see about how this decision making went down.
Well, so it'll be a very interesting period, not only for Cindy Martin, who will have to go through the Senate confirmation and then serve, and then for San Diego Unified, these are going to be some really interesting conversations over the next few weeks. Does Lamont Jackson remain the superintendent for the whole year? Does he remain for indefinitely after that? I could see that happening. Then will he make changes in the management of the district in any significant way? And then there's, of course, the pandemic. Will we ever go back to school? It's still up in the air, apparently.
Oh, right, that.
Just a note, I got a hold of a presentation that San Diego Education Association was making at its school sites. This is the union of teachers, and they want to pressure Governor Gavin Newsom to do a circuit breaker, which means a more significant stay-at-home order than we have now, some kind of lockdown similar to what we experienced in March, where nobody's doing anything at all. Beyond whether that's a realistic proposal or not, I was struck by its lack of inclusion about its hopes and priorities for vaccinating teachers or other things. I'm not sure a circuit breaker like that is possible, but that's where their head is at. We're going to take a quick break. On the other side, we'll get into what's happening with vaccinations and COVID rules in the region. We'll be right back.
Are you looking to engage with regional decision makers, business leaders, elected officials, and industry professionals committed to improving downtown San Diego? Join the Downtown San Diego Partnership. As a member, you'll receive access to exclusive resources, exposure to special programming, networking functions, and additional opportunities unmatched by any other local membership-based organization. Join the driving forces behind the future of downtown San Diego. For a 10% discount, become a member today.
Well, vaccinations have started in San Diego. We're all kind of dismayed at how slow it has been, but they are happening. KPBS tracker says 62% of the doses in the county have not been administered. A couple of stats that stood out. For those doses, about 15.8% of them have gone to Latino residents of the county, But those residents make up about 33% of the county. So there might be some hangups in reaching different populations or lack of emphasis there. One of our employees was at the in line to go to the Petco Park distribution facility, and it was quite congested. It sounded like a lot of people interested in very few vaccinations there. It seems to be going a little bit slowly.
I think so, both like big picture wise in terms of being able to secure an appointment and the number of people for whom it's available, but also like once you actually secure that appointment, it seems like it's kind of a rough wait in line and traffic and a little bit of chaos if you're at the Petco Park site at least.
There's a new Supercenter opening up in South Bay, I just heard, and at the old Sears. So California is lagging behind other states. In some measurements, it's the worst. But, you know, it's also a matter of having doses. Are we going to get the doses and how many of them are? You and Kayla, though, I want to talk about this story. So as we deal with whether we're going to get vaccinated or not, you and Kayla Jimenez did a piece about Carlsbad. In particular, restaurants there who are leading the effort to defy the orders against allowing people to dine either inside or even outside some of these restaurants. And they're using a kind of novel legal argument. What are they saying?
So one thing that had sort of intrigued me for the last few weeks is, you know, I don't live in Carlsbad. I live in the city of San Diego. And certainly I've encountered plenty of restaurants that are not adhering to the state's rules and are providing more than just to-go service. But they're all sort of doing so, you know, kind of on the down low or quietly or not, you know, not making a big scene about it. And so what was so interesting about Carlsbad is the fact that they seem to like all be open aggressively. And they're saying like, we are publicly flouting the rules because it is a peaceful protest. And, you know, that's clearly a nod to the First Amendment and your right to protest and assemble. But that struck me as a pretty weird legal argument. And so I talked to some First Amendment experts who threw a lot of cold water on that and said, you know, that that's really shouldn't insulate you from having to follow the law. You know, one even went as far as to say, like, well, if I rob a bank and I say I'm protesting laws against robbing banks, that really doesn't count as expressive conduct, and I still stand to be punished for robbing the bank. And so, you know, another pointed out that most people who engage in civil disobedience and protest do so with the express acknowledgement that they will be punished and arrested. You know, we just celebrated Martin Luther King Day. Martin Luther King Day was jailed for peacefully protesting. And then he went into it with the knowledge that that was likely to happen. And so the idea that this would sort of insulate you legally, I think, is questionable. That's not to say that some of these laws that the state has imposed, that they can't be challenged in some way. You know, maybe the science behind them is lacking, which is something judges have been sympathetic to. But that's not a First Amendment argument. And I also was struck by a lot of these restaurants that have signs up that say we're engaged in a peaceful protest. They actually also have separate signs up that say, this isn't about politics. You know, we're just trying to keep food on our employees' tables. We just want to keep our doors open. We don't want to go under, which certainly tugs at the heartstrings, but it's also kind of expressly acknowledging that you're not engaged in a peaceful protest and you're not doing this as a, you know, political act. You're doing it because you're a business and you want to make money. And that kind of cuts against the idea that it's a protest somehow.
Yeah, it's almost like it feels like kind of a meme that got out of hand, right? Like you have like there was a lot of people making the point that when the protests this summer happened over racial justice and criminal justice issues, that, you know, why weren't they being criminalized, even though a lot of them quite, you know, very much were. Unlawful assemblies were declared quite often. There were a lot of people arrested. There was a lot of consequence for people who participated in those protests. But they're basically saying like, well, if you can do that, why can't you do everything X thing? And it's like, and that got to be this kind of Republican play for a while of like, oh, I'm just peacefully protesting, when you'd have like the Republican Party said that when they were having a gathering for election night or debate night or whatever it was. So and now that has gotten extended to this like full legal argument about these restaurants operating.
Yeah. And I talked to one First Amendment expert who kind of made this point at like the conduct that you're engaging in order to be protected as expressive conduct. People need to be able to recognize what it is you're doing or saying. And that doesn't necessarily have to be through your voice. You know, Colin Kaepernick knelt on the ground, or you can sit down during the Pledge of Allegiance. And I think that's pretty, people understand what you're doing when you do those things. It's a political act, even if you're not saying words. But if you looked at a restaurant that has always served food for years, has always opened its doors and served food to people, and it continues opening its doors and serving food to people, it's not clear that anyone would look at that restaurant and say, oh, obviously what they're doing is a political act of protest against the state's coronavirus restrictions. It's not clear that anyone would get that. And so whether or not that counts as opposed to somebody standing in the street saying, end police violence, that's very, very clear.
Yeah. Well, and that's not to minimize some of the struggles that a lot of these industries are having and their employees, incredible unemployment requests and data, a lot of struggles to keep some of these businesses open. There was one thing, though, that stood out for me. I don't know if you've followed this. The state obviously has had a lot more money than it ever thought it would have during this period as far as the government bringing in tax revenue. Most of that has been in reference to the income taxes, the wealth taxes that a lot of people who have made a lot of money in the market recently are having to pay. But I noticed this week there was some more numbers about state's performance. So in December, for example, the state had been projecting that it would bring in about about $2 billion in sales taxes, and it brought in $2.3 billion. There is just a lot of economic activity happening, even though the economy's so shut down. It's really quite something. You can tell, like, once it really opens up, it's going to be bananas.
Yeah, it's such a weird kind of dichotomy of everything's closed. But at the same time, like, I don't know if you've tried to buy anything online in the last 9 months. Everything is sold out. Like, please take my money. And no one has any size small leggings to spare.
Yeah, there is a special like Planet Money episode or something to be done about all the weird things that are out of stock or hard to find, or like there's surfboard shops where they were like, no, I'm not going to repair your surfboard. I have 150 to do. It was, yeah, RVs. Yeah, exactly. Well, there was another story in Voice San Diego this week about COVID data and COVID issues, and it was about who gets to know who has COVID and where they live. We have, of course, requested some of this data and have not gotten it. In fact, we lost our case at the appellate court. They said, we're not even going to hear it. We're going to appeal, it looks like, to the Supreme Court to get some of that outbreak data. But they also... there is one group that has gotten data about who has COVID and where they live. The police. What is the deal with this story?
Yeah, so we obtained a batch of emails between the county and between the sheriff's department detailing how the county public health officials were providing the email or the actual addresses, the home addresses of people who've tested positive for COVID. So, you know, at the same time that they're saying the public can't know which businesses are the source of outbreaks and, you know, make decisions about whether they want to patronize those businesses or in what way they want to patronize those businesses, they're giving actual home addresses of patients to police in case they get a call at that address and can look and say, oh, they have a COVID patient there. I should probably take some steps to protect myself. And this is allowed by state law. but it's certainly jarring.
Yeah, and Jesse Marks talked to a few people. What was some of the reactions to the news? It seemed like it surprised a few.
I think it surprised a few, but mostly it was, you know, law enforcement officials defending why this is a good thing. And at the beginning, in particular, they wanted to ration their protective equipment and there weren't mask mandates necessarily, which is all, you know, perfectly reasonable explanation. But if that's the case, you'd think it would extend to the public as well in terms of, you know, what businesses or office spaces or churches they want to go to in person.
Well, if you have any information or experience getting the vaccine, not getting the vaccine, or getting the COVID, and you want to share what it was like or something we need to look into, let us know. You can always email me at scott@voiceofsandiego.org. Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast. It's the most popular public affairs podcast in San Diego. We want to reach more people like you this year. We think this podcast is good. So if you agree, please share it with a friend. And of course, be sure to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. And give us a rating on like the Apple. You know, something nice. You know, these guys are good. These folks tell it like it is. Whatever. It means a lot to us. Thank you. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief. Sarah Libby's Managing Editor. And this show was produced expertly by Nate John. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week.